Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Restricting calories and training nonstop is a familiar course in the pursuit of peak athletic performance. But researchers warn that for women, the negative effects will eventually catch up to them. The syndrome is called the female athlete triad. Outside Magazine contributing writer Christine Yu recently wrote about the condition. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Christine joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So what is the female athlete triad? I assume there's three functions to it.
Yeah, so it's something that affects active women and girls, and it consists of three interrelated conditions. So the first one being low energy availability, the second one being disturbances in a woman's menstrual cycle, and the third being low bone mineral density. So what happens is when you don't take in enough nutrition, the body doesn't have enough fuel to support the physical activity demands that you're placing on it. And, you know, the body is smart, and when it doesn't have enough energy, it begins to shuttle the resources that it does have to those critical systems for survival, right? So like your heart and your brain, and it shuttles energy away from non-critical systems, so like your reproductive system, and that can lead to changes in hormone levels such as estrogen, and causes those changes in your menstrual cycle, so like you could lose your period. But the thing is that, and the way this connects to the bone mineral density, is that estrogen is actually super important for bone growth. So when a woman doesn't have that, you know, natural monthly surge of estrogen that occurs during her menstrual cycle, particularly during like early adolescence and early adulthood, it really affects how she accumulates her bone mass and builds bone. So those periods in which, early adolescence and early adulthood, those are really critical bone building periods. So if you're not getting you're not building enough bone during that time, you could put yourself at risk for, you know, early onset osteoporosis and, you know, repeated stress fractures and the like.
Is there a comparable condition for men?
So this is really interesting. So researchers are starting to look into it because they do see some similar symptoms in men related to low energy availability. But the research is really in the early phases. In 2014, the International Olympic Committee put out a paper proposing this term called relative energy deficiency in sport, or RED-S, basically linking some of these similar syndromes and saying that, you know, this isn't just limited to something that to women, but that men can experience it too. And in fact, it can also affect other systems like your immune system, protein synthesis, even mood disorders. So researchers are starting to look into that and trying to identify, you know, what's actually going on here.
Is, you know, Title IX hasn't been around forever, and women in these sports in this condition, there just haven't been that many until the last four decades, really. Is this something that just has picked up steam and is very noticeable?
Well, so it's interesting. There, you know, the researchers do believe that there's likely a connection, right, with Title IX and, you know, this huge influx of women into competitive sports, mm-hmm. And just more women being active.
Right.
You know, I think that there's a lot of different factors going on, right? So you have all these women coming into sports. You have most of the research, right, on kind of sports medicine and physiology that are focused on men and what's happening in men and not necessarily what's happening in women. So, mm-hmm. you know, we apply a lot of the training rules, right, and training regimens that men typically do, but we apply them strictly to women. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that are going on. And I think that, you know, at least recently, we're beginning to recognize, right, that this isn't something that's normal. You know, I think that there's a lot of beliefs, you know, particularly in like the endurance world or the running world, that, you know, you lose your period as a matter of course, right? It's a natural part of training. It shows that your body's adapting to a high training load. But people are recognizing, you know, actually that's not a good thing for your body. You know, that shouldn't be happening and it's not normal and we should be talking about it.
You know, you start your piece with a pro triathlete, and her experience at the 2010 Dextra Energy Triathlon. Her name's Jenna Parker. And before we get into her story, she went halfway around. She went to Australia for a trainer. And I was just shocked that you go all halfway around the world for a trainer and the trainer doesn't have the sense to know or doesn't understand what the female triad is. I mean, who are these people?
Yeah, I mean, that was
how can they call themselves a trainer if they don't understand the physiological impact of that kind of training?
Yeah, that was one of the really surprising things that I came across in my research. There was a study done. It's a little bit of an older study, but it was a study done of 240 healthcare providers and showing that really like less than half of the physicians and physical therapists that work with athletes and less than 10% of coaches could identify all three components of the triad. And only really 9% of doctors felt comfortable treating it. So, you know, again, I think, you know, and some of the doctors that I spoke with who were very involved in this, you know, they said, you're not taught this in medical school, really, or, you know, you specialize in, say, obstetrics and gynecology, and you focus on kind of what's going on just with the reproductive system, but you don't really think about how, you know, a woman's sport might affect that, or if a woman has, you know, multiple stress fractures, how that might then link back to what's going on in her reproductive system. So, yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there. You know, there's a woman, Dr. Aurelia Nativ, who is one of the physicians at UCLA Athletics. You know, she said she gets tons of calls from coaches and doctors from other places who, you know, who aren't quite sure what's going on or how to treat it or, you know, asking her questions. How can they, you know, help their athletes get back to their sport in a good way?
Yes, but, you know, it does make you question get back to the sport and win or get back to the sport and be healthy. You wrote that women can be diagnosed with the triad, but that often doctors aren't always looking for it and that it goes underreported. And you said that's because they're kind of siloed when it comes to these three functions of the triad. They go to different doctors for those things.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, if I came down with a stress fracture, you know, the first person that I would likely see is go see an orthopedist, right? And so the orthopedist is probably just going to be concerned with trying to help me, you know, heal my stress fracture and get back to normal. He or she is most likely not going to ask me if I'm having a regular menstrual cycle. And vice versa, you know, if I'm someone who is you know, concerned about my nutrition or, you know, want to make sure that, or I might be experiencing some disordered eating or even an eating disorder, I might go see a nutrition or a therapist or something. But they may not think to then ask me, you know, do you experience any stress fractures or how's your bone health? You know, do you have low bone density? So a lot of times, and especially given that, you know, our appointment times with doctors are, you know, shorter and shorter, mm-hmm. We don't get a chance to kind of they don't get a chance to really dive into those multiple pieces. There are some programs out there that are starting to be a bit more holistic and comprehensive in how they look. For example, there's a program out at Boston Children's Hospital called the Female Athlete Program, which does, you know, combine all of these different facets in each, you know, so the gynecologist and the sports physician and the nutritionist, and they're all looking for signs and symptoms of the triad in order to better piece together, you know, the puzzle that's going on.
You wrote again, as I mentioned, about pro triathlete Jenna Parker and what happened to her at the 2010 Dextro Energy Triathlon. She came down with a case of hives. What did that have to do with female athlete triad?
Yeah, so Jenna's story is pretty incredible. You know, she was a great high school and college athlete, and she kind of, you know, came up the ranks of the pro triathlon world pretty quickly. As you mentioned, she went to Australia to join a training camp there to get really serious about her training. But what happened is that, you know, kind of especially for folks who are professionals and this is their livelihood, right, there's a lot of pressure to really perform. And so she was pushing her body so much in terms of her exercise and training load was, I think it was like 35 or 40 hours per week. Yet she was also restricting her calories because there's a belief, like I mentioned in sports like triathlon and running, that the leaner you are, the skinnier you are, the faster you'll go. She calls herself a functional anorexic, right? She would kind of do the math in terms of figuring out, okay, this is how many calories I'm burning, you know, with my training, this is how many calories I'm taking in. So I need to you know, only eat this much so I don't gain any more weight. And it got to the point where her body was just like, enough. I can't handle this. And as she told me, you know, her doctors basically explained that her body was throwing up a huge red flag, just trying to get her attention and pay attention to what's going on, because basically, you know, she was killing herself.
Mm-hmm. Did it work?
So it did. So, she, you know, after that triathlon, her coach basically, you know, told her, you know, she was done for the season, told her to go and eat cartons of ice cream and pretend she wasn't an athlete. So she actually made the world championship team and had tried to start training again for the world championships. But, mm-hmm. you know, her body again was like, I can't do it. Like, she couldn't get out of bed. She couldn't go and train. So she ended up taking several months off and then started working, I believe, with a different coach and whatnot. And, you know, eventually started to make her way back in a more healthy way.
Which sports are female athletes more susceptible to getting the triad?
So there are sports, you know, that, again, emphasize kind of leanness, so running, you know, cross-country, triathlon. And then there are also sports like gymnastics and diving and swimming and volleyball, in which women tend to wear, their uniforms are a little bit more revealing, right, and more body conscious, so that there's also pressure in terms of how you look in those. So those tend to be the kind of groupings of sports where they're more susceptible.
And that's not even about performance. That's about aesthetics.
Yeah, some of it is about, you know, a lot of it is about aesthetics, because, you know, the appearance and kind of eating disorders and body image does play, you know, a role in it, although you don't have to have an eating disorder or experience disordered eating to be diagnosed with a triad, if that
mm-hmm.
makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, you know, because, you know, say for a runner who's starting off, they'll see like a senior in high school who is running super fast times, and they'll see their lean body and their build, and they, you know, there's this assumption that I have to look like that in order to perform better. And the same thing with kind of gymnastics,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, being in a, you know, in a beach volleyball bikini or whatnot. You
Let's not even go there. But I'm wondering, beach volleyball notwithstanding, because, you know, the hit's the hit.
Sure.
But with gymnastics, are judges in gymnastic competitions aware of this problem? Are they part of the problem?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know. You know, there hasn't really been research or studies kind of done on that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that there's what a lot of the experts that I spoke with talked to me about was that, you know, it's not necessarily sport that's the problem in and of itself, right?
Uh-huh.
There's so many great benefits to exercise. But it's often this culture that kind of surrounds specific sports that might encourage certain unhealthy behaviors, right? So if you have a team culture that, you know, everyone's not eating, or, you know, everyone's you know, not taking their rest days or doing, you know, extra sessions, you know, every night, that creates a very unhealthy environment in which can cause some of these behaviors.
Christine Yu, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christine Yu is a contributing writer for Outside Magazine, and we will post a link to her article about the female athlete triad on our website at wosu.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday today, and where there's a party, there's usually a cooler of ice sitting around for beverages. Maybe there's a scooper. Maybe you just use a cup or maybe you use your hands. Food scientist Paul Dawson says that ice may be doing more than cooling a cocktail. Bacteria and viruses may be tagging along. Paul is a food science professor at Clemson University. His research focuses on food quality and safety, and he recently wrote about dirty food habits for The Conversation. We'll post a link to the article at WOSU.org/allsides. Paul Dawson joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
You wrote about an incident that occurred in 1987 where contaminated ice was served at a football game in Philadelphia. What happened?
Well, the ice was made from contaminated water, and the ice was then used in drinks at a football game as well as some other events. The ice was obviously shipped and used, and when the ice melted, it actually made people sick. And I think there were numerous illnesses in that case. And there are some other examples of that around the world. Most of those occurred several years ago. But I guess the point is that ice can sometimes carry bacteria or viruses that we are not aware of. Most of us think that ice is not going to be a vehicle for foodborne illness. But in fact, it can be.
Well, how do you protect yourself against a situation like that? You know, where you're just getting the ice and it's the water that was contaminated in the first place?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think it's very rare because the requirements or the FDA standard is that ice should be made from water that has the same standard as drinking water. So that really is a rare occurrence, certainly now in the U.S. Some of the other incidents, as I think is cited in the article, are from other parts of the world, developing countries and so forth, where there's less control. Some of those are where vendors are making their own ice and selling drinks in that case, and the source of the water is not sanitary, whereas in the U.S., most of the sources are. So I think that'd be a very rare occurrence, and I guess you'd really have no way of knowing that ahead of time unless you make the ice yourself. So That would be a tough one to prevent if you didn't know.
You wrote that E. coli bacteria transferred to wet lemons and ice 100% of the time in your studies, and that only 30% of the time when they were dry. What's the science behind whether the food is wet or dry? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, that was more of our application, is that when you handle food, the previous we were talking about was the ice, actually the water that was used to make the ice. In that example, we're actually handling the ice, like you mentioned in kind of the intro.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're making a drink, or you're at a restaurant, someone puts a lemon on your garnish on your drink, and it's been handled. So we did some studies in our lab where we inoculated someone's hands or our hands and then handled the lemons or ice and then saw them transferred. So we found that, you know, you think about washing things to clean it, but when the lemon was wet and then handled, we did get transfer 100% of the time in our study, whereas when the lemon was dry, we only got 30% of the time we got transfer. And I guess that's not uncommon. In other examples, we've done studies with dropping food and on surfaces and whatnot. And certainly a wet surface is going to pick up bacteria or viruses more readily than a dry surface.
What about when you use a utensil to handle the lemon or the ice, a scoop for ice, a spoon for picking the lemon out of out of the cut lemons, does that help?
I think normally it would help. Again, in our study, we inoculated the scoop, so we knew we were putting bacteria on that scoop, and in that case, we got a lot more transfer of that bacteria on the scoop. But again, you would normally expect a scoop or a tong or whatever spoon to be clean. So, you know, if I had my druthers, I guess I'd rather have someone or myself use a tong or spoon to pick up the ice. But in fact, if it's laying there and poor sanitation has been used, the point was we'd get a transfer to the ice in that case.
What kind of restaurant regulations have evolved from this these issues?
Yeah, there's a lot of these particular issues. There's probably not particularly one, but generally there's some strong monitoring. You know, you go to a restaurant, there's usually a grade outside, A, B, or C rating.
Mm-hmm.
And So there's inspections, and typically it's just measuring the sanitation practices and the sanitation of a restaurant. So there's, in the U.S., again, a lot of that's a local phenomenon. There's the local agencies that do that, not a federal. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you are. But generally, there's good control for public health in that case. So you can go, I know if I see a restaurant doesn't have an A, I kind of, you know, I may not go in, mm-hmm. may walk back out, because that's just an indication of the sanitation practices of that restaurant. So specifically to the kind of things, some of the things we're addressing, I don't know there's a specific requirement that there's some kind of check as far as the lemons or, for instance, we did one on restaurant menus, that there's a certain practice that you need to clean the menu so many times. But again, there's general sanitation. Certainly you see the signs as far as hand washing and those type of things. So there's some good regulations, but not specifically to some of the things we have addressed.
There are there are a couple things I wanted to talk about that are, you know, familiar to maybe a lot of people on a college campus. One is beer pong. You throw a ping pong ball across a table. Hopefully it lands in a cup of beer. If it goes in, the other person has to drink the beer. You studied this. I'm sure you didn't sit and play beer pong for an afternoon, but how did you study it?
Yeah, we have some nice programs here at Clemson, and one was we have undergraduates work on research teams, and they come up with some of the ideas themselves, and that was one of them, was the beer pong as far as transferring bacteria. And we did that study in two parts. We actually, I have to be careful what I say here, because on a homecoming weekend, we sent the students out around campus and collected beer pong balls that had been used in beer pong games in various parts of campus. And they brought those back to the lab. And then we analyzed what was on the ping pong balls. And we also had them keep track of where the game was being played. For instance, if there was actually tailgating going on, and some games were being played outside. Other ones were being played on a porch, mm-hmm. or in the house. And so we kind of kept record of where the game was being played. So as you might guess, with the fun ensuing, that the ball obviously has missed the cup, mm-hmm. Numerous times, probably more than it goes in, and it lands on the ground, on the floor or the ground or whatever the surface is. So that was interesting, because we found that, I guess as you might expect, the games that were being played outside had much higher levels of bacteria on them than the ones being played in other venues, so to speak. But there was that first part of that study, there were extremely high levels of bacteria found on all the balls, and particularly the ones that were being played in games that are outside. And then in addition to that, we did some, it's very difficult, or a lot of the process to identify bacteria is quite involved. We did do some initial identification just to kind of categorize the type of bacteria were there, and it's a gambit, ran the gambit. But there were some that fell into a category that could contain pathogens. And the other side of that is when someone's playing beer pong, they're handling it with their hand, and, you know, hands are, in that case, that person's probably not working in a restaurant where they're worried about washing their hands. So mm-hmm. they've got bacteria on their hands or virus on their hands, and then, you know, there's all kinds of scenarios where they go to the bathroom, and, you know, there's a whole study about going to the bathroom and not washing your hands or coming back and playing beer pong. So all those things come into play when as far as what type of bacteria are on the ball, and then the ball, of course, goes in the beer, and then someone drinks the beer. So that was the second part of the study, once we kind of had an idea that there were bacteria being gathered on the ball. We came to the lab and actually did play beer pong, so to speak. We inoculated people's hands and then let them handle the ball and throw it into a, you know, glass. And we used both water and beer, and then enumerated the transfer, and found it, of course, almost 100% of the bacteria that was on the ball ended up in the beer. So there's kind of the two parts of that study. And it is a very interesting study, and I guess, you know, we had fun doing that. But yeah, that was beer pong, and then we did some review of the literature, and it turns out that there's actually a World Series of beer pong.
Right,
kind of interesting, and the founder of that, I don't have his name in front of me, but he actually talked about at these events there's what's called pong flu, and He wasn't sure whether that was due just to the late nights or whether it was partly due to the beer pong or what. So we had kind of some fun with that study.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about bad food habits. My guest is Paul Dawson. He's a professor of food safety at Clemson University. If you have a question for Paul Dawson, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Another, I guess some people think of it as a common practice, but I call people on it if I see them doing it, so beware, is double dipping. You know, that is taking a potato chip, dipping it in the dip, and then taking a bite of it, and then dipping it in the dip again from the same place you took the bite out of it in the first place. And that's just horrible, but apparently people do it.
Yeah, that was another one. Yeah, we had the students, and that did that several years ago, actually, but that was a very interesting study because that idea came from the Seinfeld episode. Probably most people remember that.
Yeah.
With George at the wake, and Timmy caught him, he caught Timmy double dipping, and had a whole ensued argument there. But yeah, actually, we had that idea. I initially, just my gut feeling was in thinking about the bacterial surface area and whatnot, that when you bite a chip or a cracker, at the surface area really that your mouth contacts is very, very small, relatively small. And so in most cases, so when you dip that, I was expecting some transfer, but not necessarily one that was measurable. But in fact, we first did that study, we did three parts of that one also, or that one, and we did it just dipping in water. We'd bite the chips and dip them, and then also have a control where we just dip the chip in there or a cracker in there as a comparison to the other two treatments. And we found there was significant transfer to the water. So we followed up with a second study because we thinking, well, dips aren't water. They're usually some type of different acidity level. So we did three different pH levels in water and again found significant transfer. So we finally did a study with real dips, and that was we used salsa, cheese, and chocolate dip, and they actually are three different acidity levels themselves, which was interesting. So we set an experiment up where we did again direct comparison of dipping a chip without double dipping, and compared to biting the chip before we dipped it, and then actually held those dips after we had done that for 2 hours, kind of simulate a party, and really found, you know, some things we didn't really expect ahead of time. And again, we found there was a significant transfer, much higher level of bacteria from the mouth than the biting, I guess, in the dips, in all three dips. But we found that the salsa initially had more bacteria than the chocolate and the cheese. And after we thought about it a little bit, we went back and did some other analyses because you think about it, when you dip in salsa, it's a thinner dip, and it's more of the dip going back into the common bowl than it would be with cheese.
Right.
So we did actually measure that. We did the weight sticking to the chip and the dip, and then also the viscosity of the two, measured that. We had some little science behind that. But then after 2 hours, again, as you might expect, the pH of the salsa was lower. The numbers decreased over those 2 hours. Now, that sounds like good news, but they still end up being about as high as the chocolate and cheese. We started out lower. So, that's somewhat good news, but the fact of the matter is, if there's someone at the party who is, like a typhoid Mary or is actually overtly sick, that they're likely to be transferring whatever they've got to the dip. And so, if you follow in there, you might, it might be a way that that kind of illness is transferred.
Let's see. Elaine in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. The last few years, my daughter and I in our household have taken to religiously using a fruit and vegetable spray. The one I use, the brand name is Fit. I'm sure there are other ones out there. And I want to know if you could tell me, are we wasting our money, or does that stuff really help to spray it on and either rub it, or in the case of like broccoli, just rinse it after you spray it?
Yeah, they do work. Yeah, we've actually done some studies for industry on some of those rinses and washes, and that because that is a concern. Fresh vegetables, obviously, we in the in our field, food safety field, we call it, there's no kill step. When you cook food, that's what we call that, a kill step. You don't have that with fresh fruits and vegetables. So, yes, mm-hmm. Rinsing those does work, and it's good practice. There are, the more, as you've mentioned, scrubbing done, that helps too, because there are.
I'm sorry, Paul Dawson, are you there? Okay, we've lost Paul Dawson. We'll get him back. Thanks, Elaine, for that call. Hopefully people are on this. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. Hi, Paul, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I was talking. I guess you couldn't hear me.
Okay. As far as another thing that kind of surprises me is the whole issue of blowing out birthday candles. Wow, I guess that makes a lot of sense, right?
Right, yeah, we did a study on that also, and we found that there was some transfer of bacteria when blowing out birthday candles. Now, an issue with a lot of these studies is that there's a lot of variability, as you might expect. One person blowing a birthday candle out may not expel as many water droplets as another.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's an interesting thing. Some of these studies, we do background work and kind of looking into that. And again, people in the medical field, this is not new. And people who are in the dental area, working in the dental area, is probably not new either. But there's obviously, just when people are talking, they're releasing small droplets and bacteria along with that from the room. There's some studies about that in a room of people talking, how many bacteria are released. And also, obviously, when someone's coughing, you hear about that all the time. Cover your mouth when you're coughing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, when you're blowing, you're actually kind of like coughing. It's going to be the same thing. So we kind of had thought, well, what happens when someone's blowing out birthday candles? And sure enough, there's transfer of bacteria blowing onto the surface of cakes. And we did a study with that, with actually little candles and icing. And again, yeah, there's transfer there. It's probably not a real big problem, I guess, but again, it comes down to if someone is sick and they're at a birthday party and they're the one blowing the candles out, then there might be, they may want to watch out for that, I guess.
Just give them a cupcake, tell them to blow out the single cupcake, save the cake for the rest of us. Certainly don't want to affect our access to sugar.
and also it's tradition. And actually, again, the fun thing about some of these studies, we did kind of a little where that originate that practice, and there's some evidence back in the first time that was used back in the 1700s, blowing birthday candles out and so forth. So, yeah, that was an interesting study. And I guess the other thing that I'd like to follow up on that at some point with the research is, you think I would guess that the very old and very young would be the ones we'd have more concern about, both exposure to that and also probably not as good at, or they're transferring more bacteria or droplets when they blow because they have less control over their saliva, I guess.
I have an email from Amy. She says, how about the food server that prepares the food and turns with the same gloves and then uses the cash register?
Well, that's probably a no-no there. Yeah, that's an issue with gloves. So some people, I guess it's a, in their mind, they're thinking the gloves are kind of protection, but they're really not there to protect them. They're there to protect the consumer from that. So, yeah, some people, they wear the gloves and do multiple tasks. So, yeah, every time a task
changes, you have to change gloves.
You need to change to throw them away. Mm. So, yeah, that's definitely not... not a good practice.
Sue in Delaware, you're on the air with Paul Dawson. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Kind of like your previous email that you just talked about, what I have run into again and again and again is I am buying meat or seafood that is unwrapped at a display case in a general grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten into the habit of really watching when that person comes over to wait on me. Do they already have a glove on? If so, when they start to go after what I'm after, I say to them, what did you last touch with that glove? I had this happen last week, and the man kind of looked at me, and he said, and he picked up a package of prepackaged ham. And he said, oh, this, I wasn't touching the ham. And I said, yeah, but how many other people touched the package? Oh. And so every time I call it to their attention, they seem to get it, but they don't seem to think about it until I draw their attention to it.
Right.
And I cannot tell you how often this happens. So
yeah,
the question I have is, other than the grocery chain itself, how does that ever get monitored other than by the consumer?
Paul Dawson?
Yeah, probably the consumer. Yeah, they obviously difficult to monitor, have a government or regulator there monitoring them, unless there's maybe a camera. But yeah, it would be the consumer and the chain that's doing that, I would guess. Again, because it'd be almost impossible to have someone there watching all the time. But yeah, it just reminds I've seen that at other, for instance, some of the sub chains that make
right.
the sandwich in front of you. You know, you'll see that most of the time they're pretty good about changing their gloves, but they need to be reminded that those are disposable gloves. And once you touch some other surface or do something else, do another task, it's get a new pair of gloves on. I understand that completely. Yeah.
One more call, and then we got to go. Thanks a lot to Vicki in Grove City. You're on the air. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I just had a quick question. You were talking about ice machines. I had rented a party room at a prominent hotel for about 80 people for my husband's birthday, and that evening my husband got sick, and the next day I got calls from 50 to 60 people stating that their families had gotten sick as well. In the process of narrowing it down, the only common denominator was the ice, and I found out that apparently they don't have parties of that size very frequently, and no one had bothered to clean the bottom of the ice machine, and they were actually down to the bottom. I was banned from that hotel for ever coming back because I was complaining about it. But what kind of illnesses can you actually get from that?
That was one we didn't talk about that. But yeah, the machine itself can be dirt, not cleaned or dirty. That's a good question. What type? Typically viruses, I guess, or someone's handled that and left it there. The stainless steel obviously is a surface that is not friendly to most bacteria. But if there's any kind of moisture left in there in the ice machine, then bacteria, for the most part, and viruses can survive. So, again, the problem would be from a food safety standpoint that cold and freezing doesn't kill bacteria. It only kind of puts them in a dormant state for the most part. So, yeah, it'd be tough to pin that down unless, you know, we went back and did a little investigation, so to speak, and what were the symptoms. General symptoms, was it they have a fever or not? Then we kind of narrow it down to what it was and based on what lives in that, can live in that environment, try to figure it out. But yet, I mean, it sounded like you did a pretty good job of narrowing it down, but that was one we didn't talk about. Ice machines can be an issue if they're not cleaned.
Right.
Yeah.
Paul Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Paul Dawson is a professor of food safety at Clemson University, and he wrote about dirty food habits for The Conversation. We'll post a link to his article at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 and NPR News. Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Try as we might to avoid sweating, perspiration is a normal, healthy response to how the body heats up. For some, excessive sweating can be a nuisance and may sometimes be a sign of a medical condition called hyperhidrosis. We're talking about sweat, what's normal, what isn't. Joining me by phone is registered nurse and emergency medical technician with the nonprofit International Hyperhidrosis Society, Angela Ballard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
So why do we sweat?
Well, it's a basic body function to keep us at a stable temperature. So we need to sweat. It's like our air conditioning.
I noticed that the better shape I'm in, the more I sweat. Is that typical?
Yes, it's very typical. In fact, elite athletes will sweat more than the average person. They'll often start sweating sooner when they begin exercising and will sweat more because their body knows what to do. It jumps right into action when you start exercising and starts cooling you down. So sweating during exercise is not a bad sign. And it also depends how acclimatized you are to the temperature of your environment. If you're used to exercising in a hot environment, you'll also start sweating sooner and may sweat more. Whereas if you travel to go run in a race and it's much hotter than you're used to, it may take you a little longer than someone else to start that body cooling mechanism.
There is a myth that sweaty people are nervous or have hygiene issues. What about that?
Well, we do sweat when we're stressed. Mm-hmm. That is true. But for people with hyperhidrosis, which is this medical condition of excessive sweating that's uncontrollable and about 4 or 5 times the normal amount, they will sweat no matter what. Whether they're stressed or cold, they may still be sweating. We shouldn't make judgments just because someone's sweating that person is nervous or is unclean or is taking drugs or lying. Like, there, people make judgments about sweating, but sometimes sweating is an unavoidable medical condition. So we have to be careful what we think about the people we run into every day and recognize that sometimes there's something else going on that we may not know about.
When does excessive sweating suggest a serious medical problem, or is there such a thing?
Well, so excessive sweating can be a symptom of another medical condition. So if you have a new pattern of sweating, if you didn't used to sweat excessively and all of a sudden you do, you should definitely talk to your doctor about it because that's a new symptom and it certainly could be related to a different medical condition that should be diagnosed and treated. But after that, if your doctor and you figure out that there isn't a secondary medical condition going on or it's not a side effect of a medication, it might be its own medical condition of hyperhidrosis. And hyperhidrosis in itself can be treated. There's a number of different options. And you want to start thinking about controlling or managing your hyperhidrosis if it's getting in the way of your daily life. If you start making decisions about your career, your hobbies, whether you go to that party at night or not, or whether you hold your girlfriend or boyfriend's hand or not. If sweating is starting to impact your life, then it's time to get help.
There are two types of sweat glands. What are they and what's the difference?
Well, we have our eccrine sweat glands and our apocrine sweat glands. And the first one is actually for cooling the body. That type of sweat is mostly just water and salt, and it evaporates very quickly, which is how the body releases heat and cools down. So that's really the more common type of sweat. We also have sweat glands that are more localized in our underarms and actually in our genital region where we have hair. And those sweat glands release a kind of a thicker, milkier type of sweat. And that's the sweat that we release when we're stressed, when you're giving a presentation in front of your boss or you're at a job interview or something like that. And that sweat does not evaporate nearly as quickly. And when it interacts with the bacteria that naturally lives on our skin, it causes that potent body odor smell. So stress sweat really smells more than exercise sweat.
Why do we sweat in stressful situations? What's the physiology of that? Why? What's the need for it?
Well, we don't.
It just
really
makes me more nervous.
I know, right? I'm starting to sweat just thinking about it.
Yeah.
We don't really know. So evolutionary experts have some theories. So animals release odor as well, and some animals sweat as well. And we know that the scent of fear is a real thing, and that animals can smell the the sweat or other odors released by, say, their pack mates when they're scared. And it's kind of a warning signal, like, oh, I'm in danger. You know, you can smell that I'm scared, that I'm in danger. You know, maybe that means you need to get away. So sort of a protection of your pack. So there's some theories that maybe early humans also used scents to communicate with each other, obviously unconsciously. So there may be something about that. Or, you know, we talk, you've probably heard of pheromones. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an odor in itself that we can't detect consciously, but subconsciously we can. So there's a number of evolutionary reasons that perhaps this developed, but we don't use them as much now, obviously.
Sometimes people talk about sweating out toxins. There's, you know, saunas, people do hot yoga.
Right.
What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, so your sweat is basically water, and it has some salts in it, and it has some, like, sodium chloride and potassium, but you can't sweat out toxins. Your kidneys, your liver, your lungs, your digestive system, those are the body systems that rid your body of wastes. Your sweat glands reside in your skin. They're not connected to your body's waste elimination system, so they don't actually release any sorts of toxins. If you want to help your body get rid of any bad stuff, you need to eat right, stay hydrated, and exercise to keep your organs functioning properly. There's no real shortcut there. And there is a danger in sweat and forcing yourself to sweat too much. You can become dehydrated, and you know that you can set yourself up for heat exhaustion or other heat-related illnesses. So it's nice to think you can sweat out whatever you ate yesterday, but unfortunately, it just has to go through the old-fashioned way.
And you know, I mentioned that when I work out, when I'm in the better shape I'm in, the more I perspire, and it's like you could almost feel it happening. But what if you don't sweat during exercise? Is that something to be concerned about if you're working out? And
your sweating is your body's cooling system. So there is a medical condition called anhydrosis, which is the inability to sweat. And people who are unable to sweat for any reason, they are more likely to become overheated. So if you do not sweat and you're concerned about it, you should definitely talk to your doctor and look into that. Some medications can cause either a delay or lessening of your body's sweating. So it could be a side effect of your medications, but you want to talk to your doctor about it and recognize that if you're not sweating, your body's going to get hotter. So you maybe need to slow down a little bit. You maybe need to take a little off that exercise regimen until you get in better shape and start sweating more, or until you figure out why you're not sweating. You don't want to get overheated because there's a whole host of heat-related illnesses that you could suffer from.
How do antiperspirants work?
So antiperspirants, different from deodorants. So deodorants only attack odor, where antiperspirants help to prevent or delay sweating. They actually contain a metallic salt, and when you put it on your skin, the best time to put it on is at night before bed when you're not sweating. That gives the active ingredients time to start working overnight. What they do is the salts get drawn into your sweat, just the very superficial surface of your the opening of your sweat gland onto the skin, and it causes a superficial plug that basically blocks the sweat from being able to come out of your pores. And that, it's believed, triggers a biofeedback mechanism that, oh, the sweat can't get out, so therefore the gland should stop making sweat. So it's not like your sweat is building up inside your body.
Gotcha. Okay.
But they're very superficial plugs. They're temporary. The salts don't get drawn further into your body or anything like that. They typically last about 24 hours. So we recommend you put your antiperspirant on at night when you're not sweating. That gives the metallic salts a time to just form those superficial plugs. And then in the morning when you get up and start moving around and start sweating, the plugs are already formed and your antiperspirant can cause the sweating to be less. If you put it on just in the morning and you immediately start sweating, it just gets washed away. There's no time for those little superficial plugs to be formed.
Angela Ballard, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And you can learn more about hyperhidrosis and sweating from the International Hyperhidrosis Society at sweathelp.org.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.